The following talk is offered freely to ensure that no one is ever denied access to these practices and to these teachings. If you feel inspired to make a donation to support this offering, you can go to my website at jonathanfaust.com. While you're there, you can also sign up for a monthly newsletter designed to support you in your practice. Thank you and enjoy.
You know, when you spend so much time just relaxing and paying attention, there are some very interesting non-ordinary states that you can drop in. And yesterday at the 6:45 a.m. sit, for some reason I was in really, really deep. And 20 minutes in, Tara rang the bell and I kept my eyes closed and I could just, you know, just feel the bell, and then suddenly I really am not making this up. I had this experience of like being in a boat surrounded by whales coming up to the surface when they breathe. And then I realized it was about 15 people blowing their noses in the room. So this has been a journey. It's been such an honor to share this with you and to be part of the small groups. And like most journeys, you start off with really high hopes and maybe a little bravado, and then you're buffeted by winds and waves and droughts and rainstorms and locusts, and if not locusts, attacks from anger, fantasy, restlessness, sloth and torpor, doubt, fear. And at the same time, there may have been some insights and some new discoveries in your journey. And if nothing else, as I mentioned opening night, and when you reflect on this week, it's really something just to think about all the trouble you didn't get into by sitting here not saying anything. And Tara mentioned the line. This is something from Joseph Campbell in The Hero's Journey. Above the line is what you're aware of. Below the line is everything you're not aware of. And the line can move in direct relationship to your capacity to relax and pay attention. And something else emerges from your practice. And that's the capacity to observe without judgment. Not to react to every thought and every emotion, but instead to be the witness to what is changing in your experience. And you may have sensed or glimpsed more and more subtly who you are as the one who is aware. You know, life is all about stimulus and response. Stuff happens, and then you react. And perhaps here you were able to open up the gap between stimulus and response in your practice. And you might have been able to distinguish the difference between reacting to what's happening and responding to what's happening. That gap between stimulus and response can make all the difference in your life. A woman shared how she was overwhelmed with her kids acting up and was just about to react, and something in her just said, pause. And in that moment of pausing, she could sense her own overwhelm, hold that with a sense of loving presence, and then her response was completely different. The implications of what you're practicing here and how you take it into the world are truly immeasurable. You cannot measure the impact here. And so for the next 47 minutes, I'd like to talk a little bit about the journey. 5 days ago, you came from the marketplace to the monastery. And tomorrow you'll move from the monastery back into the marketplace. Just a reminder, the retreat does end tomorrow. And so you'll be returning home tomorrow, unless you find a really good place to hide around here. Always an option. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the practice of arriving that you've gone through here. And in the arriving and the landing, your capacity to see more clearly. And to talk a little bit about the process of awakening the heart in this journey. I'd like to talk a little bit, too, about refining your response to suffering. The suffering in you, the response to the suffering around you, and to talk a little bit about the call to action as you move back into your world. When you look back over the last 5 days, no doubt you've spent an awful lot of time dedicated to arriving, to calling yourself back again and again, this practice of paying attention on purpose. If you take a glass of muddy water and you let it sit on a countertop long enough, the sediment begins to fall and the water becomes more clear. And perhaps you've noticed this, a little more clarity, a little more brightness in your awareness. And someone shared about their experience of noticing this refined sense of clarity in his practice. He was practicing concentration, focusing on the breath, and he found a place in the breath right at the rim of the nostrils that he could really let his attention rest there and really gave himself to concentration. And he began to notice a certain kind of disquiet, kind of a restlessness or irritation. And so he pushed it away, and he came back to the breath. And then it came back, and he pushed it away, came back to the breath. And later he said it was like something was knocking on the door, going, hey, hey, hey. And then he decided to answer the door. And so he moved from concentration on his anchor to exploring the event itself. He decided to look deeper at it, and that irritation and disquiet was more of a churning, kind of a roiling inside. And he thought about this long-standing issue at work that seemed to be related to this feeling inside. And he thought, well, how clearly can I see what's going on here? And so as he sat with it, he saw, this is anger. And just in seeing it, there's a little bit of clarity. And when he said, well, I named it, but it didn't move or shift. Maybe I need to look even closer. And so he remembered this instruction to when you feel something, to explore letting it get big. So this roiling sense of anger, he let it get big, and he started to see that anger was actually a constellation of all kinds of other feelings. He saw there was disappointment. He was disappointed with his boss, disappointed with himself and how he was showing up. He made room for that. He saw that in there was sadness. He saw that he was making himself small to kind of fit in, and that had a quality of sadness to it. There was regret, him kind of regretting his actions and how he was showing up. And then he actually could feel and see shame, how he had disconnected from what he really wanted in life. And his lack of skillfulness was on display for everyone to see. And he described how this capacity to stay helped him see what he had not seen before. As a white Anglo-Saxon male raised in the United States, I consider myself somewhat emotionally stunted. But I found it helpful that when I finally get around to recognizing an emotion, if I look closer, it's never just one emotion. anger is a composite of so many different emotions. Grief and sadness is often a blend of very pleasant past memories of joy, but also a deep sense of regret for all the moments I missed because I was on my way somewhere else. When you look at this mind-body matrix, you see that we're a storehouse of this interconnected amalgamation of sensation and feeling and mood and story. And all of these undigested experiences that come to us when we practice, as Tara said yesterday, they all point toward an unmet need. There is something you're hoping for, something you're wanting, that didn't happen. And you may have noticed in your journey this week that sometimes when you tune in to that unmet need, sometimes what's there, it just wants to be seen. It just wants to be recognized. Sometimes that unmet need is calling for some form of loving presence, some form of empathy or compassion. Sometimes there's an unmet need for action, and quite often a recognition of that we need help and there's some action required. But you can only discern this by arriving, gathering your attention, and looking more and more closely and sensing what it is that's emerging from below the line to be seen. How many times this week have you begun again to again relax and soften and pay attention and observe what's right on that edge between what you're aware of and what you're not aware of? All these parts inside that were previously not seen, not felt, not fully heard. And a deep bow to you for the courage it takes to stay. So when you arrive and you look around and you look inside, there's always a question of what is really here? What is true? What is real? How much is illusion? How much is story? How much is confusion? And that's what this journey is all about. It's about seeing into the nature of reality. The Buddha's inquiry began when he saw someone sick. He saw someone old. He saw a dead body. He saw a wandering monk who was deeply inquiring into the nature of reality, which inspired him in his quest. In the world of change, is there something that doesn't change? So there are so many rewards to this practice of arriving, of concentration, a gathering of attention, a calming and a soothing, a heightened perception of what is changing. And you start to see into the nature of reality itself, into the three characteristics of reality. You begin to see into anicca, into the nature of impermanence, how everything that's born of causes and conditions is going to change. You see more and more clearly into the second characteristic of reality, into the nature of dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness, the unsteadiness that occurs when you try to cling or control what's happening. To the degree you resist, you will experience rope burn. And you begin to sense the third characteristic of reality, this quality of anatta, of not self. You begin to sense perhaps who you are as a product of conditioning, and to sense perhaps in glimpses this sense of the unconditioned self, this quality of vast, spacious presence. And you see inevitably in your practice that your body is of the nature to get old, to get sick, and to die. You see the reality that everyone and everything you love is destined to disappear. And you see into the nature of your own karmic inheritance, of what you came with into this world. And perhaps you get the sense that you're also the creator of your karma. And you begin to see into the nature of suffering itself. Someone mentioned in one of the small groups this week of how aware they were of the suffering in the room and how at times unbearable it felt. And this is indeed an integral part to waking up. We become more aware of the suffering in the room. We become more aware of the suffering inside. And we become more aware of the suffering in the world. And the question then comes, what do we do in a world of suffering? I was raised a Quaker. The Quakers have a great phrase that says, don't just do something, sit there. It's quite a paradox. The more you become the witness and the observer, the more intimately you can feel the clench, that inner clench that there's something wrong. There's either something wrong with you or there's something wrong out there. And again, we come back to the gap between stimulus and response. When we feel suffering, we clench. Is it possible, rather than to react, to respond? And this speaks to the awakening of wisdom and the awakening of compassion. The sense of the witness of the observer for me was quite a liberating concept and an experience. Just sense my capacity to observe without judgment. There's a great sense of peace that came with trying just to take the seat of the witness in my own practice. But I noticed there was a shadow side to that witness as well. And it had to do with a certain kind of coldness, a certain kind of indifference. It helped me to recognize that this requires the cultivation and the development of the second wing, of the awakening of the heart. When Tara told me that she was going to give a talk with a story, including me, last night, I was prepared for something super embarrassing. So I want to thank you for sparing me. You had so much more material to work with. And I thank you for not going there. Yeah. But I wanted to share an angle from my side. Tara had mentioned yesterday how when we met, she kind of went from being very robust and healthy to pretty quickly to gravely ill. And just as she was in her clinch around her health and her mortality, so was I. And previous to meeting Tara at a conference where we were both keynoting, I'd been living in a spiritual community. As I like to say, I came for lunch and I stayed for 24 years. And in a pretty dramatic fashion, things ramped up pretty quickly. I sold my house and gave away a lot of my stuff and moved down to Washington, D.C. with my car, my dog, my motorcycle, and a change of underwear. And I was still very new to the D.C. area. I was still getting lost trying to find my way back to the house. And then the symptoms started. First, there was the pain, and then less and less mobility. And we kept adapting to what was happening. And I was aware that Tara was drawing inward and retracting. And I watched myself do what most men do, try to figure it out and fix it, and hopefully nuke it. But we had no idea what was going on. The symptoms didn't fit into any one category. And then she got really sick and was in the hospital for a while. And there was one particular moment. I was home alone when Tara was in the hospital, and there was a big debate as to whether to try a pacemaker because the heart rhythms were so out. An absolute sense of being out of control. There was nothing I could do to fix this situation. And when we're in fear, the clench happens. And there it was for me, you know, sitting in this empty house in a place I wasn't that familiar with. And in that aloneness, one thing I try to do in my own practice is when I can get in touch with the embodied experience of something unpleasant, you know, fear in this case, is just to imagine I'm sitting on a park bench with it, just sitting with it. And in that clench of fear, of feeling out of control, there was a recognition. First of all, a recognition of how much I loved this woman. How much I was all in. And this combination of feeling a sense of love and a sense of loving presence, and also feeling the mystery of being absolutely out of control, there was a calming that began to descend over me. And a felt sense, like a voice saying, take the next step. And I slept well. And one day led to the next. She didn't need the pacemaker. More information came in. And her health is much better. But do you know that feeling when someone close to you is really ill and dying? If you don't, you will. There's both the clench, a sense of the vastness of things, and a call to find some kind of refuge. Anam spoke beautifully of the three refuges in our practice. Where do you go when you are utterly alone? The first is the Buddha. To be awake. To recognize what is here. To see it and name it. The Dharma. To see clearly what is true. Not my hope, not my embellishment. Not my preference, but the reality of what is here. And the third, Sangha, of love, to open to love. And I know that for many of us in the metta practice, some have found it to be very helpful, others have really struggled. And in my own struggle to find my own inner wiring to loving presence, I recognize each of us has to do that in our own way. However you wire yourself up to loving presence is a worthy pursuit. And so it becomes the question of how we respond to suffering. So I'd like to share with you a story that I only pull this story out every couple of years. You may have heard this before, but it's one of the more potent ones. I can rarely get through it without choking up. But it speaks so beautifully to our inherent capacity to respond to suffering. So if you like, you can close your eyes or you can have your eyes open. It's a relatively long story. One day, when I was a freshman in high school, I saw a kid from my class walking home from school. His name was Kyle. It looked like he was carrying all of his books. I thought to myself, why would anyone bring home all of his books on a Friday? He must really be a nerd. I had quite a weekend planned, parties and a football game with my friends tomorrow afternoon, so I shrugged my shoulders and I went on. As I was walking, I saw a bunch of kids running toward him. They ran right at him, knocking all his books out of his arms and tripping him, so he landed on the dirt. His glasses went flying, and I saw them land in the grass about 10 feet away from him. He looked up, and I saw this terrible sadness in his eyes. My heart went out to him. So I jogged over to him as he crawled around looking for his glasses, and I saw a tear in his eye. As I handed him his glasses, I said, "Those guys are jerks. They should really get lives." He looked at me and he said, "Hey, thanks." There's a big smile on his face. It was one of those smiles that shows real gratitude. I helped him pick up his books and asked him where he lived. As it turned out, he lived near me, so I asked him why I'd never seen him before. He said he'd gone to private school before and now. I would never have hung out with a private school kid, but we talked all the way home and I helped him carry some of his books. And he turned out to be a pretty cool kid. I asked him if he wanted to play a little football with my friends. He said yes, and we hung out all weekend. And the more I got to know Kyle, the more I liked him. And my friends thought the same. Monday morning came, and there was Kyle with his huge stack of books again. I stopped him and I said, "Boy, you're really going to build some muscles with this pile of books every day." He just laughed and he handed me half his books. Over the next 4 years, Kyle and I became best friends. When we were seniors, we began to think about college. Kyle decided on Georgetown, and I was going to Duke. I knew that we would always be friends, that the miles would never be a problem. He was going to be a doctor, and I was going for business on a football scholarship. Kyle was valedictorian of our class. I teased him all the time about being a nerd. He had to prepare a speech for graduation, and I was so glad it wasn't me having to get up there and speak. On graduation day, I saw Kyle. He looked great. He was one of those guys that really found himself in high school. He filled out, and he actually looked good in glasses. He had more dates than I had, and all the girls loved him, and sometimes I was jealous, and today was one of those days. I could see he was nervous, so I smacked him on the back and said, "Hey, you're going to be great." And he looked at me with one of those looks. The really grateful one. As he started his speech, he cleared his throat and began, "Graduation is a time to thank those who helped you make it through the tough years. Your parents, your friends, your siblings, maybe a coach, but mostly your friends. I'm here to tell you that being a friend to someone is the best gift you can give them. I'm going to tell you a story." I looked at my friend with disbelief as he told the story of the first day we met. He had planned to kill himself over the weekend. He talked of how he had cleaned out his locker so his mom wouldn't have to do it. He looked hard at me and he gave me a smile. Thankfully, I was saved. My friend saved me from doing the unthinkable. I heard the gasp go through the crowd as this handsome, popular boy told us all about his weakest moment. I saw his mom and dad smiling, the same grateful smile. Not until that moment did I realize its depth. Never underestimate the power of your actions. One small gesture can change a person's life. So if you like, you can just close your eyes for a moment. And you might, in your own time, take a moment to feel the breath. And if you wish, take a moment to think of just one person that you know of that might be suffering right now. And as you breathe, can you sense the resonance in the heart? Is there a sense of what they might be needing, what they might be hoping for that's not happening? And can you imagine extending your heart to them? In your own time, you can deepen the breath and feel free to remain with your eyes closed, or if you like, you can open your eyes. This practice is made of two wings, the wing of wisdom, of seeing what's true, seeing what's real, and the wing of compassion, how you hold that experience. And it's possible to narrow your view to simply look through the lens of wisdom. When you look through the lens of wisdom with no compassion, you can see the world of cause and effect. You see the world of karma. There's short-term karma. If you overeat, for the next few hours you feel uncomfortable. There's longer-term karma. If you smoke cigarettes for most of your life, there'll be a cumulative effect of those actions. And then there's sort of the long-term karma, kind of the effect of your actions down the road. We're sharing in our small group today of one of my doorways to metta is my grandfather, who died when I was quite young. He was born in extreme rural poverty and was kind of a self-made man and very frugal and saved his money. And through his generosity, I was able to go to college. Just to think of the long-term effect of that action on his part. So you can look through this world of karma, just consequences. It can be very cold. Someone falls down, well, you must have pushed someone down another life. There's a hardening of the heart, a shutting off of feeling. When people go to war, they are indoctrinated into making the enemy an unreal person, which makes it easier to kill. You can also look through the world through compassion with no wisdom, where you simply see pain and you respond to the pain without any skillful action. Man tells a story of watching a butterfly breaking out of its cocoon. and it's struggling. So he helps the butterfly emerge. He starts breaking little bits of the cocoon away to make it easier for the butterfly. And then he's horrified to see that the butterfly is deformed, because the butterfly actually required that time and that effort in order to fully develop itself. We do this all the time when we rush in without an awareness of the lessons we learn through our struggles. Helping a child figure something out rather than letting the child go through that learning process themselves. The best example I can ever think of is if you see a 15-year-old fall madly in love for the first time. You know that days, weeks, or months, their heart is going to be mincemeat. But you wouldn't interfere with that, because that's part of the initiation into this human journey. So then we have the wise heart, when wisdom and compassion are in a dance together. When you recognize that there is growth and suffering. And quite often when entrepreneurs are asked after they've made their money, what are the times you really cherish the most? And many of them speak of the struggle. The times when they were having to figure things out, when they weren't sure they could make it, and they were totally engaged. And I would guess that when you look back on this week, weeks from now, it will be the moments of your deepest struggle that may possibly be connected to the greatest insights, where you have seen something you hadn't seen before, or open to some possibility you hadn't felt before. And when you reflect on your time in the cocoon this week, again, recognizing that quite often the hardest times are the most fruitful ones. There's a men's group in D.C. It's called M3, Men Meeting for Meditation. And I'm not sure if they still do it, but I know for quite a while they would go around the circle, and each person would talk about their AFGO. So, well, my AFGO this week is... So the word AFGO, A-F-G-O, I'll change one of the words. It stands for another freaking growth opportunity. And so we open ourselves to the suffering, and we open ourselves to the joy. As much as you have felt your own suffering, your relationship to suffering, you may have also touched into moments of deep presence, moments of deep joy. And so, New Year's Eve, as we look toward heading back into the world, I wanted to speak a little bit about this response to suffering in the world. There's good news and there's bad news. But there's some amazing good news about the planet. Just a few things to share with you. There are some breakthroughs in medicine that we're going to have or are having major global impact right now. There is now a vaccine that's cheap and effective enough to end cholera, which is one of the scourges of the planet. The worldwide cases of leprosy have dropped 97% since 1985. And there's a new plan by 2020, it'll be eliminated on the planet. Since 1991, cancer deaths have dropped 25% in the United States. breast cancer deaths have fallen 39%, extending the lives of 322,000 women. The World Health Organization announced that global deaths from tuberculosis have dropped 37% since 2000, saving 53 million lives. Some other good news for the planet. Chile has set aside 11 million acres of land for a national park in Patagonia. In response to the terrible floods of 2015, Pakistan has planted 1 billion trees. Cameroon has recently committed to restoring over 12 million hectares of forest in the Congo. Brazil has started a project to plant 73 million trees, which is the largest tropical restoration in history. In the last 3 years, the number of people in China living below the poverty level decreased from 99 million to 43 million. In the United Kingdom, the birthplace of the Industrial Revolution, carbon emissions fell to the lowest levels since 1894. And on April 21st, the country did not burn any coal for the first time in 140 years. And the cost of solar has been plummeting 20 to 25% a year for many years. And by 2030, at the latest, we will not be building any natural gas power plants other than in areas that receive very little solar energy. There are many places now where it's entirely possible to do this. Global deaths from terrorism dropped 22% since 2014. Violent crime in the United States has dropped 50% since 1990. So there's some amazing stuff happening. There are also incredible challenges that lie ahead of us. When we open to this global family that we are, climate change is accelerating. Along with this will be rising sea levels, extreme weather, wildfires, drought, and flooding. And there's no question the most vulnerable people on the planet will be the most affected. There are rollbacks now in pollution controls that could have dire effects. We're going through a mass extinction on the planet, the sixth mass extinction in history, due in large part through environmental degradation. The extinction rate is almost 1,000 times faster than in previous eras. Nationalism is spreading not just in this country, but throughout the planet. There's a perception of scarce resources and a vilification of non-natives. And with that is the growth of white privilege and racism. Gun deaths continue to increase. The wealth disparity continues, increasing the gap between those who have and those who don't. And the exploitation of animals in factory farms, this inhumane act still continues. And there's a misconception, I think, about the Buddha's time. I think people tend to think in the Buddha's lifetime was a time of peace and prosperity, which is quite the opposite. In the Buddha's time, there were ongoing wars. His own community was filled with conflict. Women were not seen as equal to men in any way. He spent much of his time trying to mediate between warring parties. So inner suffering and worldly suffering was very much a part of the Buddha's lifetime, just as it is a part in our lifetime as well. So a few moments, again, just to close your eyes. And again, you might sense the breath. And just to acknowledge this ever-changing world we live in, this world that can contain breakthroughs in technology, people responding to challenges, as well as those who are not responding to the challenges, who perpetuate suffering. And sensing if it is possible to hold this with the wise heart. And sensing perhaps how in the story of the Buddha, how the Buddha set forth to respond to suffering. How in your own way you might respond. The call of the Bodhisattva to respond to the suffering within and around you. And so, if you like, you can again open your eyes. A few questions to consider in response to the suffering around you. Is it possible, at least for me sometimes, when I sense the injustice in the world, there is anger? Is it possible to channel your anger into compassion? Where there's injustice, it's easy to create an enemy. As both Tara and I have made a move to being vegan over these years, we've become so sensitive to the cruelty and the unnecessary harm to animals. I grew up on a farm. All through college, I managed a 500-head livestock operation. I have members in my family who are active and excited hunters. And it becomes such a process for me to remember that I was them at one time. That my neighbors, when I was managing a livestock operation, were well-intended people. Just as my family members are as well. How can I convert my frustration, my anger, to be able to be in compassionate relationship? And the second question, is it possible to serve in the world and keep your cup full and overflowing? There are so many people. I mentioned I grew up in a Quaker meeting and during the Vietnam era, and I saw so many angry pacifists who were unable to make that conversion. It is the ultimate challenge. There are also many, many well-intentioned people who are devoting themselves to social change and global change who are completely fried and burned out. Is it possible to balance self-care so you can be effective in the world? If you are angry and tired, you'll have a certain effectiveness in the world. If you are full and compassionate, you can have a different effectiveness in the world. Sometimes people say, you know, meditation, yoga, that it's so self-indulgent. But my sense is that part of our spiritual practice is about filling the cup. Because when your cup is full, it's easy to be nice. It's easy to roll reverse. It's easier to be in relationship with the world. Finding a way, the middle way of self-care and being active in the world is such a deep challenge. Another inquiry is, where do you feel called? Where is your calling to serve? When I moved down to D.C. 13 years ago, kind of figuring out what am I going to do? No one knows me. I don't know anyone. And Tara said, well, here's a program of teaching mindfulness to people who are incarcerated with severe addiction. And the study is exploring recidivism rates. And this would be something you would really make a difference. You could publish, and money's pretty good. And I thought, well, yeah, that's a really good possibility. And it never sat right. And then finally I realized, I don't know enough about that to really be helpful. I often ask people who are drawn to teach or serve in the world, I ask them, who do you do your best work with? Who are the people you most resonate with? It's fascinating. There's a Dr. Peter Attia, who's a physician and a neurologist, who has dedicated his work to researching the prevention of Alzheimer's. And what triggered him? He had an uncle who he really loved, who got Alzheimer's. And he watched his uncle decline. And that became his incentive to serve. So it's very helpful to sense and really take the time to ask, where do you feel called? Where do you most resonate with stepping forward? Suffering in the world is nothing new. It's been here and it will be here. But it's suffering that engaged the Buddha into his practice. As he said, I teach only two things, suffering and the end of suffering. And our practice is to bring ourselves deeply into seeing clearly, seeing what is real, and cultivating our capacity to hold it with a wise heart, to be present to the suffering in the world and to find that dynamic place of balance where you can respond in a way that feels most alive for you. It's one of the deepest questions for each of us to contemplate as we consider what is waiting as we move forward from this retreat. Let's close our eyes for a short meditation and a brief reflection. There is so much going on in our world today that makes us want to close down and to not see and not hear. It's easy to shut down in the face of suffering. But I think that's the greatest danger of our time. The greatest peril is not nuclear war weapons, not climate change, or the poisoning of the seas and soil and air, not the impoverishment of more than half the world's population, nor the murderous genocidal wars flaring up. It is not the disappearance of cultures or the extinction of species. The greatest danger is the deadening of our hearts and minds. It arises not from indifference, but from fear. We need compassion and insight into the radical interdependence of all phenomena. We need compassion because that openness to the pain of the world provides the fuel to move you out to where you need to be, to what you need to do. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.